This is Dana Lombardi. It's CelestaCon 2012. It's Sunday, and we're having Joe Yost talk about Operation Goodwood, which is a scenario within the Atlantic Wall game that Joe has redone for Decision Games, right?
Yeah.
And Joe is going to sit here and talk about Goodwood, especially regarding the controversy that still surrounds the operation to this day. And make sure, Joe, that we, for the purpose of the people listening, because a lot of them are not able to see the maps and everything, be as descriptive as you can, because this was critical because it was the attempted breakout of the Normandy Hedgerow area by the British.
Well, that's where the controversy lies.
Okay.
Exactly. As
whether it was
what,
even
was the nature of this operation.
Whether it was even intended as a breakout, but three British armored divisions were supposedly involved in this thing, right?
Oh yeah. Well, actually, it was much more. There were there were essentially two British corps.
Okay.
Involved in this thing with there were two operations going on at the same time,
and you're showing it right here, which is the
because
first and eighth corps.
Yeah.
That's the guards armored, the 11th armored, and we should have the 7th armored. Yes,
crossing the bridges later.
Okay,
I'll explain all this in terms of the scenario and the game.
Okay,
rather than just simply put a map up and say, here's
No,
what
no, I think you should go ahead and do it this way.
I'm going to present this.
All right, I'm going to need to tell Frank Chadwick, who's due at the next talk with me, that we're going to move it back, okay?
We'll just let it take as long as it takes, you know. It shouldn't be
No, you should do your thing, right. And that's why I'm saying we have to move ours back a half an hour. It's not a big deal, but I need to go tell him that right now. Go ahead and start.
Okay.
And I'll be back as soon as I can, okay?
Okay, sure.
All right.
Well, unfortunately, I had an outline set of notes, and I didn't bring them. I thought I had it in my backpack. But I know this battle pretty well enough, so we can talk about it. The whole idea is, you know, well, I was like, come on in closer.
Fine.
Can you see these things?
Mm-hmm.
You sure?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, my name's Joe Yost. I know Mark pretty well. Mark, another Mark, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I don't think I've met you before.
I was at your talk last year, but...
Oh, okay. Good. And you are?
Ray.
Ray, okay, good. Good to meet you guys. All right, so we'll talk about Goodwood, first of all. The focal point, in the sense of Goodwood, really revolved around the fact that Khan had not fallen. Now, if you remember my talk last year, the original idea for D-Day, for the British, was that, I'm going to take all this off, that Khan would be taken on the first day, and it would be used as the pivot point for all the Allied armies as they eventually swept through the Normandy plain and then pushed on to the Seine. The RAF and the British Rear Area Logistics Services stressed that Khan had to be taken, because until that happened, there wouldn't be any room to deploy fighter bomber squadrons that were supposed to be moved over from Britain. The vast logistic rear area complex that would have to be developed to push on to the Seine was supposed to be located in this area. Now, as long as the Germans held this and stuff, they could basically cover all those areas under observed artillery fire, which meant nothing could happen. So this was a big problem. It doesn't fall, you know, historically it doesn't fall until just around the 4th or 5th day of the Goodwood operation, which of course is more than 30 days later. So around July 12th, which is about a week before this operation jumps off, Monty and his corps commanders, Horrocks and those people, actually Horrocks isn't here yet, they're all sitting around saying, well, we've got to take Khan, we've got to do something. Now, it's interesting because the idea for an armor-heavy operation kind of develops from Montgomery's GHQ logistics commander. Because he goes to Montgomery and says, we've got 400 to 500 Shermans, extra Shermans, sitting in our resupply depots doing nothing. In other words, he came up to Martin and said, we've got more tanks than we know what to do with. So Monty hits on the idea that, well, infantry is very scarce for the British at this point. It's very valuable, and the kind of combat power it generates is not anywhere in equal to the kind of combat power a company of tanks can produce versus a company of infantry. And you use less people by doing this. So Montgomery decides, okay, well, I'm going to launch an armor-heavy operation, and I'm going to take Caen. That's a thing. Now, originally there were supposed to be two prongs to this operation. There was supposed to be a flanking operation this way and a flanking operation this way. The Germans were deemed to have been too strongly dug in on Hill 112, and they had reinforced that area with the 2nd SS Panzer Corps. So after some preliminary reconnaissance and forces and the problems they had just finally taking Carpiquet Airfield and clearing this area, they decided this isn't feasible. We're not going to be able to have a two-pronged operation to surround Caen. So Montgomery said, okay, well, what we're going to do is we're going to swing an entire armored corps around the basically east to southeast side of Caen. We're going to use this as our staging area, and we're going to drive down through this flat open gravel.
Yeah.
All right, so to that end, he takes 7th Armored Division, he takes Guards Armored and the 11th Armored Division, and puts them in with 8th Corps. Now, originally, 7th Armored had been with 30 Corps. And it's interesting because after they took a shellacking at Villers-Bocage on June 12th, that's where Whitman shot up their whole, basically, advance guard. That division went into reserve for almost a month, and little bits of it were parceled out here and there to aid some infantry, but it didn't fight as a division again for basically until Goodwood. So they just sat around doing nothing. 11th Armored was involved in Epsom, which is the Hill 112. They got pretty shot up. They were pulled back in reserve. Guards Armored hadn't really fought anything yet, substantial. So he takes all three of these armored divisions. Now, the interesting thing is, to do all this, they realize the Germans had total observation of the marshalling area, of where these divisions were supposed to jump off. And as you see, the front line, by this time, you had the 16th Luftwaffe Feld Division spread out across the mouth of where the breakthrough was supposed to come through. And I've got this is actually a scenario on Lannequil. It's a tournament scenario. It's the introductory one because it doesn't use logistics, only rudimentary logistics, air power and everything else. It's all programmed into the scenario. So you have the 16th Luftwaffe Field Division holding from Traun to about Colombelles, this side right here. Right. And you can see the front lines just like that. And then from the Colombelles over to this area, you have the 272nd German Infantry Division, which had finally gotten into the line around the first week of July and relieved 1st SS of holding this area and 12th SS. The whole idea originally was to get these infantry divisions in there faster so that they could rehabilitate the panzers and get them ready for a counterattack against the British beaches. So this division is finally getting in. Now you'll notice there are panzer grenadier companies. They took the 21st Panzer Division, broke it into small combat teams, and used it as a corset to reinforce the 16th Luftwaffe Field Division and parts of the 272nd. Because on their own, these divisions would never have had the defensive AT firepower that would be needed to stop the British. So you have parts of the 125th Panzer Grenadier, parts of the 192nd. You see the 200 Assault Gun Battalion, the 2nd Company, the 3rd Company, the 4th Company, and they're very important. I'll explain that, what happens with them later on. Over here you have the 346th Division holding the 6th Para and the Far Edge and the River Deves. And then you have the 21st SS kind of here. Now, so Montgomery's going to get all this stuff in and he realizes it's going to have to get there in one day. We're not going to be able to have this build up because the Germans are going to see what happens. So this is essentially one of the first problems that Goodwin encounters, and actually it's a very critical one. The fact that he can't get everything there until the night before, and it just becomes a traffic mess. That's why in the scenario, 7th Armored actually is here, but we have it coming in as a reinforcement because of the traffic jams that are back here. 11th Armored is supposed to lead the attack. Now, British Armored Division at this time has two brigades, the Armored Heavy Brigade and the Infantry Support Brigade. And it's bizarre because after all the stuff they go through in Sicily and Italy, they still fight those brigades separately. It's crazy.
It's insane. It's Montgomery.
And it's also the rest of the officer corps. I suspect that part of the problem with the British officer corps is they had taken such heavy losses in World War One. By the time you get to World War Two, they're short of experienced mid-level officers who are of quality. A lot of those guys are dead. The guys that should have been. So they don't have the leadership to break down divisions into brigades that can operate as efficiently, I think. So 11th Armored takes its three main tank battalions, puts them up front, 3rd RTR, which is the Royal Tank Regiment, the 23rd Hussars is the third one in the back, and then it's the 5 and 4 for Yeomanry, which is the number 2. So 3rd RTR, 5 and 4 for Yeomanry form a 2-battalion armor wedge. The 23rd Hussars is right behind them. They have parts of the self-propelled artillery battalion regiment with them as a kind of a combat team. So what you really have at the point of 11th Armored is just two tank battalions with another one trailing. The rifle, the motor regiment, motor brigade, is right behind them. And the doctrine at this point is, Roberts is the divisional commander, and actually I think he's one of the better British armored commanders in the campaign. Roberts, this 11th Armored, I think, performed the best of all the divisions on the British side as far as armor goes. The idea is that the tanks will overrun the front line, the infantry following will clean up the pockets, so that the armor will just, hey Frank, we'll just keep pushing on. So you've got 11th Armored leading. You've got Guards Armored, which is supposed to follow up, and 7th Armored to reinforce whatever's going on. Now, as I said before, 16th Luftwaffe Field Division, 272nd, you're going to have three British Armored Divisions here. The Canadians will be taking Caen. 3rd Canadian Division, which is operating in this area, and 2nd Canadian. The 2nd Canadian Division is supposed to get one brigade across this part of the Odon, and the 3rd will come this way, right here. And right now, the western part of Caen is in Allied hands, because the Germans gave that up after spring. But the Germans hold this part of Caen and Faubourg de Vaisselles, which is actually an industrial suburb. So 3rd Canadian is going to hook this way, 2nd. So here's the interesting thing about, if you look at this whole campaign as a whole, there are really three small battles going on. I mean, you see this in the scenario. You also have the 3rd British Division over here with parts of the 51st Highland. They're supposed to take Traun right here. They are supposed to drive this way clear and form a shoulder. The armor is supposed to come down the corridor of the open terrain, and the Canadians are supposed to take Caen. So it's interesting. You have an urban battle, you have a battle in forested closed terrain, and then you have an armored drive over open terrain. So the scenario is very fascinating because your mindset, you've literally got three different things going on as to what kind of battle you're fighting. The Canadians are literally fighting a go-in-and-clean-them-out house-by-house battle for the eastern suburbs of Caen. And these guys over here are fighting in wooded terrain. So the key player, though, for the Germans is really 21st Panzer. And we've heard all this, like, 21st Panzer was destroyed in the few weeks after Normandy, whatever, blah, blah, blah. This division to me is a real enigma because it's my contention that it really was the 21st Panzer Division that stops Goodwood, because they stop it on the first day. Now, everyone talks about the SS, 1st SS and 12th SS, and we'll talk. But the 21st Panzer Division, with the assistance of the 503rd Heavy Panzer Battalion, which has a company of King Tigers, Tiger 2s, and two companies of Tiger 1s, in addition to a heavy army anti-tank battalion, which has the PAK 43, the Barndor, the German 88mm gun, specifically produced in an AT role, totally hosed the British plan, literally by the afternoon of the first day. Because what happens is, it's interesting, that the original German commander of the 21st Panzer Fighting Group was kind of a Nazi, a Hitler favorite or a second one, whatever. He really was not a very good divisional commander. I mean, on D-Day, he's off with his either his girlfriend or a prostitute, whatever, whichever you prefer, in Paris. And it's left to von Luck, the commander of the 125th Panzer Grenadier Regiment, to actually effectively lead this division. And even he's left hanging for the first few hours because they can't find the divisional commander on D-Day. And he wanted to drive in against the airborne guys immediately. But he was told, you don't have the authority. You cannot release all elements of the Panzer Division. But von Luck is at Goodwood, and he's over here. And as far as I can effectively see, he's essentially the de facto divisional commander now. I think basically the Feitinger is still in command, but he's a rubber stamp. I mean, he's basically told, well, just stay out of the way. I'll run the battle. So the British intend now with these dispositions in mind, and 21st Panzer Division has 50 Mark IVs, and there are approximately 21 Tigers on this part of the front when Goodwood starts. So the British are going to first thing the British realize is we're going to get everybody over there in one day. So they build 6 new bridges at 3 different crossing sites over the Orne River. And the Germans, they build them in broad daylight. The Germans see the bridges being built. So it's kind of interesting as far as surprise goes. Oh, we're going to surprise them, but it's like, why would they be building 6 huge bridges over the Orne River all of a sudden? You know, so the Germans probably suspected something's going on. They build the bridges here. They have to leave, and this is another key thing, they have to leave most of the supporting artillery on the west side of the Orne River because it's too congested to deploy anything over here. So they intend to support the initial armor advance with a rolling barrage a la World War I with 25 regiments of medium, medium to light, which means 155 or 25-pounder gunfire, and 7 to possibly 8 heavy regiments, which is the 7.2-inch, and some. They actually have some, I think they have like one 240 battery that they got from the U.S., and that's supposed to create a rolling barrage that the armor moves behind. The problem is that's all on this side of the river. So what you're going to find is very rapidly the British outrun their artillery support. I mean, they have a little bit because there's the self-propelled stuff that each armored division has, and that accompanies some of the division. But the majority of the artillery support is over here and has to actually redeploy once the armor's out of the way to this side of the river to keep supporting these guys as they drive this way. Okay. Now, in lieu of that, I mean, the big shock, of course, of shock effect is supposed to be naval bombardment and the carpet bombing. So the British are going to carpet bomb this area right here very heavily, along this corridor, parts of this, and back to here. But their plan is to carpet bomb a box like that because they're thinking, well, that's going to essentially disrupt most of the German support artillery and most of what we're going to encounter. And they stop it right here. What they don't realize, and what the Germans have done, is literally have a very, very deep defense in depth ready for this. Because their defenses go all the way back to Borgabus Ridge. And as you can see here, there are all kinds of 88 flak. Now, the 88 flak companies, the Luftwaffe 88s, weren't really meant to be a primary anti-tank weapon. Those primarily were for air defense. As a last ditch measure, yeah, they would form blocking forces against armor, but that wasn't the preferred role. But the other interesting thing about the 88s is the Germans did something that I didn't find out until Epson, and usually don't read about this. The Germans don't have a lot of general army level or corps level artillery support. Matter of fact, there were only like 10 or 12 battalions of GHQ artillery support in this whole campaign for the Germans, as opposed to something like, well, a U.S. Corps would have 20 battalions of artillery, just a U.S. Corps. But what the Germans did, and you see this Epson, is they took these 88s and they incorporated them into their artillery net. They literally wired them up to whatever division or corps was in whose area of operation they were at. And the Germans have what's called an ARCO, Artillery Corps Commander, or HARCO. They're wired into his net, and they could support anything within roughly 5 to 6 miles of where they were at. So if there was a barrage coming in, the artillery commander of this division could literally call in support from the 88s behind. They would fire airbursts, which were quite deadly to the infantry. So that's nothing that actually makes the Germans stronger than they should seemingly should be. So that anyway, the carpet bombing comes in here. Now, the effect of the carpet bombing is pretty devastating on the guys in the front line. It just literally blows away the front line right here. And back here, everybody in game terms is like disrupted. They would have no zones of control. Their defense strengths would be half at best. When the British first advance after 8 o'clock in the morning, because the carpet bombing comes in at 7, for the first 2 hours, everybody they encounter is just dazed. And they're all, you know, wandering around, you know, concussed. Over here, the carpet bombing actually hits part of the some of the Tigers, turns one whole company of Tigers is almost rendered inoperable because they're literally blown upside down or buried in dirt and whatever. So, pretty good shock effect. The British jump off, and for the first 2 hours up until 10 o'clock, there's almost no resistance. The tanks are moving behind the artillery barrage, probably at the rate of... It's weird because you'd think they'd be charging through, but they're moving at like 2 or 3 miles an hour. So they're still creeping through. I guess they're worried about what they're going to run into. Once they hit this this line is when the Germans start to recover. After about by 10 o'clock, the Germans who have survived are starting to finally get their act together, come out of the cellars where they've been hiding or entrenchments, and are starting to man their AT weapons. And on the eastern flank of the 11th Armored, as it drives this way, so I'll use this red. So as 11th Armored, I'll just use this. As 11th Armored drives this way, it starts to encounter AT fire and artillery fire from the flanks, like this. Because over here, the heavy 88s, some Tigers are starting to finally mobilize, and pockets of resistance, especially Cagny, will become a very nasty place. These places are really tough. So the British are trying to drive to Bourgogne's Ridge, but this whole flanking attack now is starting to take fire from this side, and units are turning off to face it, or they're slowing down. And their rifle brigade, the motor brigade, actually comes in here to try to clear this up. So right, all of a sudden, the Armored Spirit starts to lose the infantry that's supposed to be coming by mopping it up. Because they're saying, look, we're taking a lot of fire, we got to clear these villages out. Now, interesting about the 21st Panzer is that, what I said, the 200th Assault Gun unit, why it's so critical is it's literally dotted, broken down into batteries throughout this area. And that's a really interesting unit because it was built, put together by a guy called Major Becker. And he's the guy responsible for making all those French armored conversions for 21st Panzer Division, where they took French vehicles and either put Nebelwerfers on them, things like that for infantry port, or the 76.2mm or 75mm guns, AT guns that the Germans had. In some cases, even 105 infantry howitzers, which you would have found on the Sturmgeschütz howitzer, which was at 105. And those things are liberally spread throughout this area. And as they recover, they start pot-shotting at the British armor also. And so by the time the British get to about here, they've already lost, in some companies, 20% of their tanks, you know, 3 to 4 tanks already. So that starts to bog down the drive, and Guards Armor is supposed to follow up, and they kind of get tied down dealing with all this as well, because eventually the 11th Armored guy says, I need my motor rifle brigade up with it. So that has to pull out. Guards Armor has to take on all the stuff on this flank here. So that's up until about 11 o'clock. Now, the interesting thing is, what you'll see is in Goodwood, a lot of people talk about how the rail line was hard to cross. Well, it wasn't this rail line that was the problem, or this one. There were two rail lines, one from Traurne-de-Con, one from the Vimont-de-Con, that run kind of east to west. The biggest problem is this little rail line here, which was a feeder line, because there's a steel manufacturing facility right here. This rail line was meant to bring iron ore and coal to it, and because of the type of load that the trains had to carry, it had to have a very finely graded rail line. So it had this huge embankment running this way, and that's what this is right here. And it effectively separated the battle in two places, because you see where these are broken and where the roads are. Those are the only places the armor could cross. The tanks couldn't get across this embankment, because this was about 9 feet high at its lowest, and in some places it was up to 20 feet high. So you've got the Germans on this side, and all these villages are occupied by strong points. ET means an entrenchment here, where you see ET. Okay, so all these places are occupied. The British at first try to drive this way, and they can't, because they're getting so much fire from this side that to stay on that side and not take these villages on just means destruction. So they start to cross over to the embankment. And when they get on this side, for a while it's like a temporary calm, because the Germans can't sight past this embankment. So this side is actually pretty quiet. Now there are Germans in here, but the Canadians are starting to drive down this way to tie them up. And so the British the 11th Army gets onto this side of the embankment, and its objectives are really Borgabus, Hubert Foley, Braw, and Ifs, these villages right here. Okay. Now, it's supposed that by most that had they taken these villages, Montgomery's next phase would have been to have them drive to Falaise. He thought he was, and this is where the other big controversy comes in. He was pretty optimistic about this. He thought, well, we could be in Falaise by the second day, if everything goes our way. And that's where the big controversy about what kind of battle this was supposed to be is. Did he really sell it to Eisenhower as I'm going to be in Falaise in 2 or 3 days, and it will be a breakthrough, or we could be there, but in the meantime, what we're really trying to do is tie up German armor so that anything the Americans are doing is free from a German reaction, as far as that goes. I think it's a little bit of both. I mean, obviously, any commander who goes to the lengths to do this kind of operation is going to want to have tangible results, and just denting in. Now he did the most tangible result is Kahn completely falls to the British, because once this is done, the Germans cannot hold this part of Kahn anymore. So that's a very tangible a goal that is reached by the operation. But for the investment of this much armor and stuff to simply take that amount of terrain and get stopped. I think there's a little bit of cleanup going on after the campaign, whereas Montgomery's going back and saying, well, all we really meant to do was tie up German armor. I don't think that's true. I mean, I think he really did want to break through, and I think he was counting on it. But, things kind of went the other way. So we talked about what the 11th Armored Division is doing. So the 11th Armor continues to drive, and what I think really happens is, like I said, Goodwood is really effectively stopped on the first day, because by the time the 11th Armored Division gets to the villages out here, Braz, Hubert Foley, and Soliere, a lot of their tank companies are down 50%, and the Germans are building up a heavy anti-tank screen right here, and this. Cagny, this village never falls. The Germans hold that completely, which, it effectively keeps the breakthrough constrained to a very narrow width. So you can't deploy the armored divisions effectively to use all their mass. They could really never get... They didn't have enough space to deploy even two armored divisions side by side. So they had to follow up one another. And all that happened is the first armored division would come up on day one, and in trying to take these villages, by the end of the day, the 11th Armored Division had lost 130 tanks, out of about 200. So they're like two-thirds of their armor force is gone by the end of the first day.
All by combat, or were there also breakdowns as part of it?
No, it's combat. The bad thing about the good thing about the Sherman is it's reliable. Bad thing about the Sherman is, it's easy to knock out, and it generally doesn't have the firepower to take on German tanks. So, effectively, by the end of the first day, Roberts tells O'Connor, says, "I'm pretty much fought out. You know, we'll be able to do some limited thrusting in the morning, but you better bring, you know, you, where's 7th Armor Division? Guards Armor is tied up just fighting, trying to keep the eastern perimeter clear, because eventually 12th SS starts to bring its conf groups up this way. 1st SS comes up from here, and parts of 2nd Panzer come from here. And by the end of the by the beginning of the second day, there are now Panther and Tiger companies from each of those divisions starting to form a ring around where the British had broken through.
Well, why didn't the British able to capture that one village? Did they actually get into it and get thrown out, or what happened there?
Well, they didn't have enough infantry, basically, is my read on it, because they
not
had
enough total or not enough up with the tanks?
Not enough with the tanks initially, and not enough total. Oh, well, in the town, originally it was just an 88 anti-tank wing with entrenchment and parts of the 21st Panzer Division, a Panzer Grenadier Company, and an 88 flat company. But by the end of the first day, those King Tigers I talked to you about, two of them are in that town. Two King Tigers with another Panzer Company of Panzer Grenadiers well dug in, and 88s. And the thing that makes that place so deadly is the terrain around it is open. So to approach it, you have to move over at least a mile of open ground against ranged AT weapons that can essentially get 80% kills at close to 1,500 meters.
And they're beyond the naval artillery barrage at all?
Well, here's the interesting thing. At the end of the first day, as I told you guys before, all the British artillery is pretty much out of range of this area. So it all has to redeploy to this side of the bridgehead to support the advancing spearheads. But there's so much congestion because there are three armor divisions trying to move down that narrow corridor. They can't get the artillery anywhere near where it needs to be and set up.
What about the fighter bombers? What about the aircraft?
There's too much... That's an interesting question, but the problem is there literally is too much confusion going on in the front lines to reliably call in airstrikes, because the Allied guys were people on the ground were very reluctant at this stage to call in air power when they had their own, especially when their own tanks are moving around, because more likely than not, you were likely to get hit by your own air power. The Germans aren't moving around. So the fighter guys are flying around, and they're seeing stuff moving. And this is something they really only work out. The Americans only are the guys who work this out, and it's not till about when the Cobra jumps off, which is a week later. Up until this time, most of the Allied ground forces were leery of Allied air support. That's why, you know, the best thing for the Allies, fighter bombers, was armed interdiction ground interdiction missions, which generally took place about 3 to 4 miles behind enemy lines. And the naval gunfire, they didn't use a lot of it in this battle, because once the situation gets fluid, you can't reliably call in gunfire and have it responsive enough to hit where you needed to hit rapidly. It's
weird.
They're worried about getting hit by their own shells. It's not like there's a lot of. They just don't really have it down in a mobile situation how to call in support fire.
Well, didn't they have a saying? The Allied infantry in Normandy have a saying that when the German Air Force came over, the British ducked. When the British Air Force came over, the Germans ducked. And when the American Air Force came
over, everybody
ducked. Right? So
probably, yeah.
Yeah. So I mean, it's like, I understand what you're saying about, you know, air power. Yeah. It sounds good on paper, but in the reality, if it's not able, because you think there's a village.
Right.
Only the Germans are in the village.
Why can't they plaster the village?
Well,
they end up hitting the wrong village half the time.
It reminds me of the Bulge, where that town that never ever was held by the Germans, ever, got bombed 3 days in a row by the Allied bombers.
Which town was that?
It was like Hoopalaz or something like that. It was a Belgian town that the Americans were in. The first day the American air power came over, unfortunately didn't kill anybody, but right. they immediately say, stop bombing this town, this is where you got under our control. They put American flags on everything. The second day they came over, they bombed again and killed people.
Right.
The third day, they were shooting back at the American bombers. Okay.
Yeah, I've read anecdotes. Now, in terms of how this plays out in the game, the air power and the naval power, up until about August 1st, when you first use air power in this game, if you're the Allied player, if you call in an airstrike, the more closed the terrain is, in other words, if it's woods, forest, towns, or city, the more likely the chance of the mission scattering. So, additionally, the more enemy flak that's in the area, the more chance there's scattering. So if you're playing this game and you're the Allied player, you start to call in a lot of airstrikes on the front line, there's about a, and I figure this is about the historical occurrence of friendly fire, there's about a 20% chance that you'll get hit by your own airstrike, if it's not completely open. There's about a 40% chance that the mission scatters and hits nothing. I mean, that it just hits a, you know, it comes in and then it doesn't even, you know, have any impact at all. So what you find as the Allied player for the first month in this game, your best mission is just to put it on air interdiction. Put as much air power as you can behind the enemy line so every time the Germans try to move, it's more costly and they have to move in slower leaps and bounds. With naval gunfire, if you call in a naval gunfire mission against a hex in this game, during the follow-up combat phase, if a hex was the target of naval gunfire, you have to roll to see if you can advance into it. Because the whole idea is, you know, while this attack was going on, they're pummeling it with 14-inch or 15-inch shells. Soldiers aren't very keen to advance during that kind of barrage or follow up really quickly. Because to just make it automatic would give a game player too much power. That's the thing is, in a lot of games, the player is given too much control of a support fire. He can do exactly what he wants, and it lands where he wants, and he pretty much has a good idea of what the effect is. That really shouldn't be the case. It's like, you know, at least not at this stage of the war. By late 44, yeah, they had a really much better idea of where their support fire was going to come in. Because another thing that happens in Goodwin, by the way, is after about 2 hours, the artillery barrage outruns them, just like it did in World War I. The barrage has kept moving on, but, you know, little things happen to slow the lead companies down, like a tank will fall into a... There'll be a ditch where they didn't see a ditch or something like that, and a tank will fall into it. It might be the lead tank of a troop of four or five, and so he calls his, you know, his other two tanks come in to push him or tow him out. When you read about that, it seems to have no effect in the greater scheme of things, but when you're following an artillery barrage, it's a timed artillery barrage, and you're held up for just 5 minutes, you know, you compound that by three or four times in the course of 2 hours. It's like this, it's the friction of war. It's the little things that come in that throw monkey wrenches into the greater plan. So by the time the spearhead hits the villages of like Soyer and Grenfell, well, first of all, there isn't even any artillery barrage out here. That's another bigger problem. But by the time they hit these villages out here, Demoville and Manel-Fredmontel, there's no artillery support. So now they're facing Germans with anti-tank guns and Panzerfaust and things like that, and they don't have enough infantry. So, and the artillery was meant to keep all those guys' heads down. So that becomes a problem here, and it's even a bigger problem out here. Because you can imagine, once you get out to these villages, you're essentially doing tank charges against dug-in infantry in closed terrain, you know. And even the commanders at the time, the guys, they're not stupid. The British tank company commanders are telling him, you want me to go into that village? Where's my infantry? And he said, well, we don't have any, but orders are to take it by nightfall. And they do it. They try it. They're like, okay. They literally, you know, would take 10 or 12 tanks, try to drive into a village and lose three or four of them.
But they just not have a concept of combined arms? What's going on?
It's mystifying. Because, and it's funny, because by the time you get to
November, December 44, they've totally reorganized all the British armored divisions. At this time, remember I was telling you that each British armored division is essentially composed of two brigades, a tank-heavy brigade and an infantry brigade. In that British armored division, there are effectively four tank battalions, three with the armored heavy brigade, and one it's called the Armored Reconnaissance Regiment, but it's really a tank battalion. And
it's got Cromwells.
It's got Cromwells, right. That's the tank regiment that has all Cromwells. And then, of course, there are three motor infantry battalions and one half-track battalion that are the infantry. The half-track is with the armored heavy task force, and the motor infantry battalions are with the motor infantry brigade. So you have four and four, and you'd think someone would have said, gee, four infantry battalions, four tank battalions. Huh? What's the most effective way to do this?
Two and two.
Exactly, and that's what they do, and they start to do the biomarker garden.
How many battalions are armored? Of the infantry battalions, how many have?
I'm not clear on that.
How many are tracks and how many are aftracks?
You said three motor, one.
Yeah, and this is what's weird.
That infantry's gotten up and down. They just can't keep up with the tanks.
Well, and this is what's so interesting to me is. Given all the sources I've read on this, I still can't pin down how many have half-track. I know for certain that the motor rifle battalion in the armor brigade has half-tracks. They all have the... Not only that, they talk about... They create part of the traffic jam because just one company of a motor rifle battalion in the armor thing has 23 armored vehicles. They have 19 Bren carriers, you know, two of which carry mortars. The other little bit of towed AT communications, and they're almost used like for reconnaissance, and they have 14 M3 half tracks. Okay, that's a lot of, and that's just one company in the battalion. By the way, the British Motor Rifle Battalion that's in that armor is one of the most powerful fighting establishments the British had in terms of infantry for World War II. Because that battalion actually has something like 895 men in it, as opposed to the 700 that are usually found in a British regular motor battalion or infantry battalion. So they purposely beef those guys up. But I've read accounts that the other three battalions also at times have half tracks. Which, and then some say they don't. So it's kind of mystifying me as no one. There's the official TOANE, and there's whatever they got their hands on once they got there. So in the game, I just gave them motor rifle. They're motorized infantry battalions, and you pretty much they're not armored. So they would be walking. And I think that had to be the case here because the fact that they didn't keep up with the tanks meant they weren't in half tracks. That other
double blind call, as far as knowing what's there.
Well, you can't peek at stacks and things like that. I mean, and
I'm talking about that's one of the things when they say go ahead and take the town anyway that we were talking about.
Right.
Well, what's the bidding there? I don't know. Then why are you trying to go? I mean, if there's only five Germans in there that's sort of a screening force.
Right.
And if you've got 15 tanks, you're stupid for not to try it.
Yeah, well, as a matter of fact, an example of that happens in the U.S. Army in the Hurricane Campaign. In November of 44, after they've broken through by Geilenkirchen and they're driving on the Roar River, and this is something you would think is suicidal, because the Germans have AT weapons all over the place. There's a company of M5s, Stuarts, right? They're supposedly the light tank company of the separate tank battalion. And by this time, they're mostly used just for supply, to haul up supply to the front line things. These things never get involved in actual front line action. Well, they're moving up to the front, and there's a village that's bypassed. No one told them, and they encounter resistance, and the commander just says, to hell with it, charge. They literally put the metal in at full speed, light tanks, charge against this town. And there were there was a German infantry company with some 75-80, and they take the town. They didn't have any infantry with them. So obviously the guys in the town were ready to surrender or something. But part of it must have been just the shock and the speed with which they hit that town. I mean, no commander in his right mind would ordinarily do that by late 44 with Stuart tanks. So
Yeah, but by Market Garden, they finally figured it out. They pair up an armored tank battalion with infantry, so that you now have four fingers, each with an armor and infantry company. But they don't do that at any time during the course of the Normandy campaign that I can see, which is bizarre, you know. And part of it must just be the lack of, lack of imagination on the British Armored Officer Corps, or...
Did they share information? I mean, you remember Guderian instituted that thing where they shared all the information among the panzer divisions.
Right.
So that you spread it out so everyone is getting this information.
Well, it's like a lessons learned, and they come out with those bulletins.
I don't know if the British Army was doing anything like that.
I remember reading something about it. It took some relearning. It starts with... It's one of the good things, you know, everybody has generic issues in Montgomery. But apparently, because the British are really insular, and you're talking with your regiment.
Your regiment, right.
You didn't talk to anybody else. And when it got to brigade, it was like, you wouldn't even ask the guy over there for help. That would be sort of admitting
that you don't know what you're doing.
That you don't know what you're doing.
Right.
So, and Montgomery had a real tough time. That was one of his biggest efforts starting North Africa, is getting that head mindset slapped out of the British middle officer ranks.
The Americans had lessons learned, the British had lessons forgotten.
Lessons forgotten, yeah. So, anyway, effectively, by the way, Traurn never falls. The 3rd British Infantry Division is not able to take this town here, which was their goal. The Germans hold on to it like for dear life, and they parts of 21st Panzer Reinforce, parts of 12th SS. The Canadians do take Caen. The British armors up here on the second day, they start to try to take these villages. They still don't. They get into these villages here. They cannot take Burgos because the Germans by that time have 1st SS Panzer Division dug in really well up here, 12th right here. As it said, 2nd Panzer is coming this way. So effectively, and then it starts to rain on the evening of the 19th. Battle starts on July 18th. By July 19th evening, it starts raining and getting muddy. Effectively, the armored aspect of Goodwood is just really called off by the end of the second day. There's some mopping up that goes on the 20th, but they've lost so many tanks and they've lost so much momentum, they just call the battle off. But the sad thing for the Canadians is they keep telling Canadians, well, you know, we want to tidy up the line. And the Canadians end up taking this and then driving toward Verrier. And this, a lot of the Canadians normally consider this place, this is their Vimy Ridge of World War II, the Verrier Ridge. There's really heavy fighting that goes on in an infantry-style fighting for this area here. It, because along these banks, the terrain is actually kind of somewhat cut up. So there's little ravines and things like that that make it very hard to drive this way. And the Canadians battle for a week trying to take this ridge and camp. But effectively, Goodwood never gets further than this, and then the Canadians are left to try to clean that up. And it's another 2 weeks before they start to try to drive down this road again. But in looking at it, the key things are the traffic congestion, the fact that there was too little space for the amount of firepower they tried to deploy initially on the first day, kept them from deploying the full combat force of 3 armored divisions. They're effectively just sending 1 armored division at a time against the front line. The second thing was that the 21st Panzer Division actually performed very well. Beyond all expectation in holding this solid flank right here and just totally shooting up the armored divisions as they went by and tying up Guards Armored. This is Guards Armored's first real divisional action as a division, and it performed pretty badly, actually. So when this battle is over, about a week after, the corps commander, the divisional commander for Guards Armored is relieved, Erskine. He's taken out. A lot of the brigade commanders in that division are gone. 7th Armored has a divisional a change of leadership.
They do. Guards Armored was here.
Yeah, 7th Armored, it's weird. They were really gun-shy. Quite frankly, they were another one of those divisions that just figured they had done their share and they're all fought out. So they follow up Guards and 11th and make half-hearted efforts to, oh, they help the Canadians drive this way. But the 11th Armored Division Commander Roberts is continuously asking, he's literally on the phone saying, where's 7th Armored Division? Where's 7th Armored? Where are you guys? You're supposed to be following up and help me take these villages. And the division commander is constantly saying, well, we're held up, or somebody got lost, or something like that. They pretty much, I think they just malingered. I think they were not anxious to get into the battle.
I read somewhere where basically the attitude of 7th Armored was, we've been fighting since the Western Desert Group, and you know, we fought all the way across Libya, back, and all the way again. We came,
and they were in Sicily, and they were in Italy.
It's time for someone else to do this, to fight.
And to them, the shock of the hedgerows and stuff was quite, you know, these guys are used to open desert warfare, and then all, I mean, and of course, although they were in Italy, but then, and they really had their heads handed to them, you know, by Whitman and those guys. And I think this division was just like, you know, we're going to do as little as we can to win at this point, because we did so, like you said, we've done so much already. It's tough, and what's weird is that, you know, the British actually had a fresh armored division in England. I forgot what the number was. I think it's like the 23rd or something like that. And it never gets sent to the continent, you know. And these guys all know that. And they were really, you know, all these divisions, it's like, why are we here? And there's an entirely fresh British armored division that never gets sent to Europe. Yeah.
That was true about a lot of infantry divisions, too. They were going to fight for the last colonial. Or grind up the guys who were already there. You're not getting any more British troops.
And right.
It's crazy. Well, didn't they break up several divisions in order to...
59th. Two divisions were broken up in Italy to provide manpower replacements to the British. And then by the middle of August, the British 59th Division is broken up. And they're broken up to provide replacements. In the Guards, in the 7th Armored, there used to be the County London Yeomanry, 3rd County London Yeomanry, and 4th County London Yeomanry Armored Battalions. And by the middle of July, they're combined into one Armored Battalion because they don't even have enough guys to man a full tank battalion among two. So, manpower is just a big issue. And like I said, the thing that drove Goodwood is the fact that they were getting short on infantry, but they had a lot of tanks, you know. And in fact, what you do see is the shortage of infantry means a lot of these bypassed strong point villages can't be cleaned out fast. So they just become thorns in the side that, you know, slow the whole advance down. Monty had said, well, you know, the whole front will burst in flames. That's what he told Eisenhower. Someone said, he just didn't consider the fact that the flames would be British tanks.
When's this going to be out?
We originally had thought we were going to get out in the summer, but it needs extensive a lot of play tests, because this game is so much...
Are you doing blind testing, like sending it out to people?
Yeah, we've got three groups, and it's being put on Vassal now. Okay. And once the guy doing the Vassal module should be about another 2 months. Once he's done, we're going to send that out to a couple of other groups too, and they'll be that way. They don't have to worry about table space. But it's 7 maps, you know. And
right, but this is a scenario within the overall monster.
Right. As a matter of fact, this is the playing surface for the. It's a tournament scenario that lasts only effectively 6 game turns.
And how many encounters for that scenario?
Probably about 200.
Total.
Yeah, I mean, and it uses it's the first scenario in the rule booklet, and it's an introductory scenario in that. It uses a very rudimentary air system where you just have so many air points. You don't have to worry about calling in airstrikes and doing the scatter thing. We just kind of built in how many air points you get to that. And the Allies don't have artillery units. We just give you so many barrage points that you can use depending on where your forces are. So it's meant to be played really, you know, basically meant to be played in 2 hours. It could be a tournament scenario, and
gets you into the combat system. One of the things that this really focuses on is the difference between the Allies and the Germans in Normandy is that the Allies completely rely on massive amounts of support fire. It's their artillery, their air power when they can get it, air when it hits the right place, and the naval bombardments and stuff like that. The Germans don't have anywhere near the support fire, but what they have is tactical superiority up front. They have better machine guns, they have better anti-tank weapons, longer range, better tanks. But the Germans have to pretty much put everything in the kitchen, in the store window, right up front to stop the Allies. Which means that stuff burns out, and they just can't keep replacing it the rate the Allies can. Conversely, the Allies have to keep shoving guys into battle in the front so that it essentially flushes out where the Germans are so the Allies can call support fire on those places. So it's an interesting dilemma. In this game, as a German player, you'll be able to develop more combat power up front than the Allied player because German tank, all the German armor is in tank companies. The Germans can stack tank companies for free with Panzer Grenadier battalions of the same division. The Allies can't. So that means the Germans can put more guys in a hex, which makes their upfront power stronger. They have better tanks. All the armor is rated on a scale from 1 to 7. And each differential better that you have is almost like a half of a die mod. So, which is, in a lot of games, like one shift on a CRT. So the German player, if there were no support, if there were no artillery or air in the game, the German player would just mop the floor with the Allies because he has way better, at least in the Panzer formations. Now the infantry formations are, the infantry divisions are not as good as the Allied infantry divisions. You kind of think of them as they're placeholders. They're just there to hold parts of the front line that are hopefully quiet, and that can allow the Germans to concentrate their armor where it's needed. We used to talk about it in game terms as it's like the Germans have hammers with no handles once the infantry burns out, because you have this great Panzer force that you can sometimes apply at a place where you're attacking, but you have no leverage because you have no infantry, because the infantry has to essentially hold those parts of the front so that so that you have a fulcrum to swing against. And the fact is, the German infantry gets burned out in this battle really quickly, and it takes the German player constantly has to throw his armor in the front line where the Allies are attacking to stop him, and he just won't have enough steps to last through till August 1st without there being a breakthrough. But you can counterattack as a German player in this game, if you're willing to take the losses, and you'll actually see in a lot of cases the weaponry superior the weapon systems in that regard. In one playtest that we had, the British player tried to take that village I was telling you that was really hard to take that had the King Tigers in it. He deployed almost half of a British armor division, like 3 tank battalions, 2 motor infantry battalions against this village where it was entrenched. But the Germans had a King Tiger in there, 2 Panzer Grenadier companies, some engineers, and they were all really dug in. The odds were really high in favor of the Allied player. It was like a 4-to-1 assault. But in this game, if you attack with armor in open terrain and the defender has heavy AT, which is it's rated 6 or better, like Shermans are, our armor is rated, most Shermans are 4. The Fireflies are 5 on defense. So on a Sherman company rated 4, the 88s, flak 88s are 6, but the 88 ATs are rated 7, and the King Tigers are 7. So a 4 up against a 7 is 3 bonuses for the defender, because you have a differential of 3 in favor of the defender. In open terrain, those bonuses are multiplied 1.5 times. So in a sense, I don't know, how many of you guys have played Battle for Normandy, the GMT game? Okay. To put it in terms of most games you've played, it would be like that
that armor bonus differential would be like four shifts to in favor of the defender. So he came in with about a 4-1, but the armor AT rating was such that the Germans had like a minus 40, because it's a 100 percentile die, minus 40 on the die roll, which is almost like five shifts on a combat table. And the result ended up being almost a stalemate. Each side took like two step losses. But because there was an artillery phase before that, in which the Germans were able to barrage, and the British were out in the open, the British took another two or three steps. So the British essentially lost five steps against that village, and the Germans lost two, and they couldn't take the village. And the guy who was running he used Guards Armor on that. The guy who was running Guards Armor saying, literally said, I can, and each turn is about 6 to 7 hours. So that he did that in the afternoon game turn of the scenario. He says, I can do this two more times, and if I don't take that village, this armor division's done. Because I can't lose 12 to 14 steps, you know, just to take this village. And what happened is, he tried a night assault, and nobody took any losses. So the next day, he basically decided just to mask. He said, I'm not going to try to take it. I'm going to keep trying to drive this way. Because it just took too much combat power to try to take out that village, given the fact that it had such a heavy AT rating. And it was well dug in. That's an ET2, which is like a second level entrenchment. And if you're it's in a village. So even if you call in maximum firepower, in this scenario, you'd have about a 20% chance of inflicting a step loss with the barrage. The other thing you could do is sometimes you can get what's called, it's like a disruption, which gives you a shift if you attack. So he had tried to barrage it and he whiffed. He called in a lot of artillery, two barrages, and got no results. And then he came in with, like I said, slightly more than half of a British armor division, and ended up losing about five companies, five steps. And the Germans lost two, but the Germans, you know, had some guys behind it, so he could just feed some more guys in and he'd still hold the village. So the fact is, the fact that the Germans had a well-echelon defense in depth that extended probably 3 or 4 miles deeper than the British thought. The British thought the German lines would be only about 4 or 5 miles deep, when in point of fact, 6, 7, 8, 9. It was almost, I won't count this because this wasn't built up strongly. It was almost 8 miles deep, the actual defense in depth that the British, the Germans had formed. And they formed strong points in each of the villages. And because they're anti-tank weapons, the long 75s were effective out to about a kilometer. It was like a checkerboard defense that the British couldn't rapidly take apart. With, you know, like I said, without a lot of infantry going in there, and you don't really see, you never see on the Western Front again an attack like this, where someone just tries to take three armored divisions. I can't think of any instance, definitely none beyond in Normandy, and I can't think of anything else even during the rest of the war where someone just says, "Let's try to take three armored divisions and break through with very little infantry," you know. So this was like a one-time deal. He tried it, you know, and maybe it was simply because he had the tanks to burn. The interesting thing about the tanks, but the statistics showed is, if you have a tank crew of five, a five-tank crewman, when the tank is knocked out, it's like 1.75 crewmen die. Two are wounded, and I guess like 1.25 are totally fine. And of the wounded, you usually get back one of the wounded guys in a week. So if you'd had I like to think of it in terms of comparative firepower, I like to think of a troop of tanks in the British sense, which is five tanks, probably has about the same type of power to take and hold as a platoon of infantry. Or if you want to say a company of tanks generates about the same firepower strength as an battalion of infantry. Well, a company of tanks, 15 guys, is only about 80 men versus 800. So you could have the whole tank company knocked out and expect to get at least half of those, have half of them back within a week anyway. So
replacement-wise, we only lose 40 guys permanently. But if you have a, in the same position, you take an infantry battalion and try to take an objective, 50% of an infantry battalion is 400 men versus 40. So if you're the British commander saying, well, we have a manpower shortage, you're gonna look to your tanks to do the job, you know, more and more. And the Russians, it's interesting because the Russians kind of have that problem by late 44, 45, where they're running out of riflemen too, in effect. You know, it's like when they overrun parts of the Ukraine and Belarusia and even Poland, they're just literally going into villages and saying, you are now in the Red Army. You know, but
Russians, comrade.
Yeah. But what they do is they, by, unless they have long periods in which they can build up, they just let their division stay at half strength, and anybody that's going to be a part of the main assault, just they just get, you know, all kinds of specialists added to them. That's where the breakthrough artillery divisions, the SU regiments, and the cavalry mech groups and stuff come in to supplement the firepower, because the infantry has no firepower. They can't take anything anymore. You know, they're pretty much good just for holding on to villages after everybody else has blasted the Germans out. So, yeah, it's like by everyone is experiencing shortages of infantry by 45. So, but the British just had that problem, and you know, their problem was already showing it, you know, itself by 44. So, Goodwood. Well, I mean, so we've talked about it. Any questions? Anybody else have anything else to say?
One of the things I got the impression, even if this was not an intention before right. the battle, is that it was sort of a full dress rehearsal
right.
for what the Americans are going to do. Because he all the way from the bombardment with the heavy bombers ahead of time, right. and then a lot of things didn't work for a lot of reasons.
Right.
I'm just going to say the British did it, that's why it didn't work. But, you know, there are a lot of things they had to learn, and did they share this information with the Americans so that the Americans, when they did it, were able to do better?
No, but the Americans, it's interesting for Cobra, which is a week later, I don't know to what degree the Americans looked at Goodwood and said, boy, they really screwed up. I kind of suspect not at all, because, but what they had already, you know, when they do Goodwood, they have the 2nd and 3rd Armored Division. I mean, when they do Cobra, they have the 2nd and 3rd Armored Division by San Lo, and they pair each of those divisions up with a U.S. Infantry Division. And not only that, they motorize the 1st and the 4th Infantry Divisions to a degree, and they cross attach. They sit there and take a combat command of 3rd Armored, mate it up with 1st Infantry, take a regiment of 1st Infantry, attach it to a 3rd Armored Division. And then after they do the carpet bombing, for the first 2 days, it didn't look like there was going to be a breakthrough. They had to grind through they had to grind through all the various things that were happening at the front line and stuff. But they had enough infantry, so every time there was a little town or village or something that was holding them up, they could literally detach like a battalion of infantry that was with them and say, clear that place out. And they had the ability to do that. They had a very combined arms approach by that period of
not the, because they learned from the British how to do
nothing I can see. No.
Okay.
I think the training cover might have taken away the long range anti-tank capability a lot from the Germans.
Oh yeah, there's that
everything
too.
Everything was a point blank range until the breakthrough.
Right.
Until after they got beyond the Bogage.
That's true. It's interesting because a lot of games.
My impression of the training Goodwood is it's all open. It's like you said, little village, big open space.
Yeah, it's like a checkerboard.
Big open space.
Yeah. It's almost like the Soviets at Kursk, forward those pack fronts, but with checkerboard ATs and it's. But this was a ideal for that because these Norman villages. Even farms with a little bit of work could be turned into fortresses because they're stone built, you know, with a lot of cellars and things like that. And you could literally turn those into mini fortresses, you know, and just stick behind even a squad.
Is the big game you're going to do include the fighting that the one mountain that's south?
Mount Pisang?
Yeah, southwest of Khan. It was World Tank Regiments and Churchills.
Oh, that's Hill 112.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, no. This the game we're doing now covers the entire campaign through August
23rd. I remember reading about that, and one thing that happened to the British is they'd get up to the top of that hill, and the Germans were still in the airfield back at Cannae.
And they could fire flanking
88s. They fire into their rear position.
Right, right. Well, and the British actually take the top of the hill momentarily, and the Germans launch a counterattack with parts of the 2nd SS Panzer Corps and the 101st SS Tiger Battalion, and they come and they launch their counterattacks before the British have dug in. So the British don't have, they're not wired into their naval gunfire nets yet. They, you know, people aren't sure exactly where all the units are, so you can't, you're reluctant to call in heavy amounts of a support fire. And then, so the Germans immediately counterattack, and it's just like a free-for-all at the top of the hill. And it almost becomes like the top of the hill is almost like a no-man's land, because no one can actually survive at the military crest, because each side's on the opposite side of it. Anybody up there is just hosed. Either, you know, the Germans either use Nebelwerfers to just blast the top of the hill, or the Allies use naval. If the once the Allies realize we don't have the hill, they you know call in fighter bombers and naval gunfire. So it's just a mess. When one of our first playtests of this is interesting. At the end on the evening of June 6th, the British player doesn't quite have Khan, but instead of, you know, he's think, but the American player, the guy who's running Omaha next, he's like, well, how come you're not driving in? And he's got, the British guy's got all these markers to show that he's digging in. Because in the game, you can't call in naval gunfire defensively unless it's from a field work, an improved position or fortification. The idea being that the location has been surveyed enough so people know where you are, and there's phone lines back to divisional HQ so they can reliably call in gunfire to support. And the British player tells the American player, he says, well, look what's coming in. You know, 12th SS was on the road, 21st Panzer was being gathered. And they're really powerful units as far as, like I was talking about, up front. They don't have a lot of support fire, but they can really hammer you if you don't have your artillery set. So the British player was telling the American player, I'm digging in, because if I'm not dug in and that stuff hits me, I can't use my naval gunfire to, you know, because initially on June 6th, the British don't have a lot of artillery ashore. So he's he has to rely on his gunfire to help him out. And historically, that's what happened. Kurt Meyer tries to throw together a counterattack on June 7th against the Canadians who are coming, oh well, you can't see it. They're coming this way to Caen. And he launches a counterattack with, I think, half of the Mark IV Battalion and his Panzer Grenadier, the 25th Panzer Grenadier Regiment. And it's the 17-pounders and naval gunfire that stop it, basically. And you see this later on in the German reports. By the middle of June, the Germans are already saying it is just hopeless to try to counterattack the Allies anywhere where they are within range of their naval gunfire, because they're just going to blow the attack. You know, they'll blow the attack to pieces. You know, so.
Joe, when you have this project, you said had 7 maps,
yeah,
and it's got kerjillions of counters.
Yeah,
you have physical play tests as well as virtual play tests.
Mm-hmm.
Are there, with a project that large and this involved, right, do you have any special problems or precautions for revision control to make sure that all of your playtest teams are playing with the same version of the game?
Well, we have.
And that no one's like inventing some house rule that improves a problem that
if it's a blind,
doesn't get back to you?
If it's a blind playtest group, you can't always be sure what they're doing. I mean, you know, with Vakdam Ryan, we had one guy who said he was running a group and blah, 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 and it turns out he was solitaring the thing. Mm-hmm. You know, we didn't know. He's giving us reports like, well, you know, and it's like, so I met him at a con and said, hey, so who's in your group? He goes, oh, well, a lot of guys made it the first week, and then they all dropped out, so I just kept doing it myself. And that was the first I'd heard of it. It's like, you mean you were solitaring this? You know, and what's even worse about that is, at least if there's a group of people in a playtest group, they can come across a rule and argue about it and what it means. And then, of course, that has to come back to the developer because, you know, well, we've got two different interpretations of this rule. But if a person is just solitaring it,
Well, there is none of that. And not only that, the guy could he could have been making up house rules, and there's no one to tell us, you know, that he wasn't, or that he was playing it that was meant to be. We do have a rules developer who has the master set of rules, and every time there's a revision, that gets disseminated to all the groups saying, here are the updates. You know, well, we have a monthly update, if not sooner, if we need it. So, you know, ostensibly everybody's playing with the same set of rules. You know, and we have one group that's trying. The way the scenarios in the game are broken down are, we have a Goodwood scenario, which is only basically a quarter of a map. Although we're going to backprint one of the maps with the Goodwood area blown up. So you'll actually have big hexes. These are standard size hexes. I've just blown this up. But it'll make it easier to play that, you know, give it more, so you're not trying to cram in, because they're big stacks in Goodwood. So we have Goodwood, Epson, which is the Hill 112 battle you talked about. And then each of those are like half map or less. Then we have a one map, which is just the battle for Cherbourg. So you have the British, the U.S. 7th Corps driving to take the Cherbourg Peninsula and the port. Those all use a form of introductory game rules, not the full-blown system, but it'll acquaint you with the combat system and everything else. Then we go to the larger scenarios, where there is a July 2nd, and each larger scenario encompasses the entire front line, from the entire British sector to the entire American sector. So July 2nd is all the way from the mouth of the Orne all the way down to Lassay on the, I forgot the name of it, the western bay on the western side of the Cherbourg Peninsula. Then there's July 2nd, there's a July 24th scenario, a mega scenario, which is Cobra, but it also has the British side, and the British do, I think the week after that, the British do Totalize, so that's their major operation. And then there's an August 6th mega scenario, which is the day before the Germans launch the Mortain counterattack. So you can choose, as the Germans, not to do that counterattack and just start falling back, rather than to attack further into the bag, is what effectively that was. And then there's, of course, the June 6th. Now, each of the mega scenarios can be broken up into, let's just play the British sector, or let's just play the American sector. You know, so we have one group that's playing just the small, testing the small scenarios. We told them, don't worry about the big scenarios, because it'd be impossible to play everything if we didn't do that. So they're playing small scenarios. Another group is playing one set of the mega scenarios, and another group is playing, you know, another set. And once we do the virtual stuff, hopefully we'll find another group to do, another two or three groups to do some of the other scenarios that still aren't tested. But it's big. It's huge. You know, we've literally postponed releasing this for a year, because we realized it's going to take 2 years of playtesting, at least, not just one, to get this all covered. All right.
Great.
Any other questions or comments? All right.
Thank you, Joe. Appreciate being here. Thanks for being here. All right.